Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Our additional burden, not just to make this case that it's important to eliminate barriers and it's important to share resources and to bring more people to the table. I mean, it's hard for people to even recognize inequity. We've been so trained to ignore it. We've been so trained to rationalize it. We can see how horrible apartheid is, but we can't see that with our own indigenous peoples and how quickly we're able to just dismiss their basic humanity.
That's the voice of author and professor Dr. Darren Lund. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Lund about the challenges of teaching about privilege in an environment where many refuse to even admit privilege exists. Stay tuned for the interview right after this song.
Eres color, eres calor, eres sonido de mi corazón, manos de luz, reflejo. fresh color.
That was song titled Reflejo de Luna. Just a pretty melody that I guess it celebrates the diversity that exists around us. We are very privileged to have Dr. Darren Lund. He is a professor in the Faculty of Education at the University of Calgary and co-editor with Paul Carr of The Great White North, Exploring Whiteness, Privilege, and Identity in Education. Very happy to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Sylvia.
Now, when we talk about white privilege, what do you mean by that?
What are you talking about, whiteness? I don't know anybody who calls himself white. That's racist. That's kind of the attitude that that a lot of people have because we're not used to. And when I say we, I'm speaking with about my white brothers and sisters who we're not used to thinking of ourselves as racialized people. So I think the kind of exploration that Paul Carr and I were trying to do in that book and with our other work is to try and implicate white people in this discussion, that racism and discrimination and colonization and all of those really big, complex issues are not just the issue of people who experience them on a daily basis. We are all implicated in racism and all of those other forms of oppression. And so the study of whiteness is not an attempt to center whiteness again in the discussion. That is, it's always about us, but in a way to problematize our own racialized identities and all the privileges that entails.
I was thinking about the way in which we look at the things we value in society. So when you think about the great thinkers of society that we learn in education, there seems to be a scarcity of authors that are non-white. So is there a correlation between the canons of education that are valorized and this sense of white privilege that you speak of?
Oh, I think so. Our privilege even plays out in the academic literature on privilege. I mean, there are excellent scholars of color across Canada who've been doing this kind of work for years and whose, you know, work hasn't garnered as much attention in the mainstream press, let's say, as our book did when the Globe and Mail did a little piece on it and then people got a little bit excited about it. I mean, there are all kinds of excellent scholars doing work around racism and anti-racism. But this issue of whiteness, though, I think it's a very difficult one for anyone to bring up, particularly in Canada.
I was in a class recently with, it's in our class, and one of our classmates was showing pictures, photos that she had taken of an indigenous community in Guatemala that doesn't speak Spanish, is distant from the main city. And she explained with great pride that she had gone there to teach them how to do art. And we said, well, don't they do art? And she says, well, not in a medium that can be readable. And so, of course, I asked her, I said, well, what does that mean, readable to whom? I mean, if art is an expression of that culture, wouldn't it be readable to them and therefore of value to them to have a medium that they produce themselves, that it evolves out of that? And so I want to talk a little bit about this notion that, or perhaps you can inspire us and open our eyes to it, how we not only decide what is art, but we also decide other things like what is democracy and who's democratic and who has the right to have a democratic system and how the system should look. How do we begin to engage our students to challenge these notions? And what would you
recommend? Well, this is a challenge. I mean, you've raised about 3 or 10 excellent points there. And I think those questions are very important as well. I mean, you hear it in the discourse, you hear it in that way of speaking about the other, right? That way of speaking about indigenous people, that their experiences, their worldview, their way of living, and even their aesthetics and the meanings they make in the world are only important if they're readable to Western ways of thinking. And that's so ethnocentric and it's so demeaning, and yet the well-meaning liberal white people who go and try and do great work, they're all about development, right? So it's all about, you know, making the world a better place in their mind. But in a way that is so problematic, the stance that many people take is so problematic that we can't even see the ways in which we're just recolonizing again. And so there's questioning all of that work and helping those people reframe their work, that is, reframing development work. But there's also the issue of, as you say, as educators, how do we raise these issues in a meaningful way with our students who have also been raised in this system, right? And I'm in a faculty of education where most of my students, probably 85%, I would say, are white, middle-class females who don't see the world as quite in quite such problematic ways, that they're, things are just fine. And so it really involves a fracturing of a way of thinking, and then so creating discomfort, but in a way that leads to education. So it obviously a complex process that can't be done in one workshop, I would say, but there's lots of different ways we try, I guess, as educators.
Eduardo Galeano is one of my favorite poets, and he writes about this notion of speakers and listeners, who gets to be the visionary and who gets to be the followers. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about perhaps some experiences or examples you've had in your studies or in your classrooms, where it's clearly that, you know, the classroom is, the majority are visible minorities, but who sets the rules? How do we challenge that environment? How do we problematize the inequity in that?
It's such a difficult task, particularly, I mean, for anyone, for of any identity to do this work in classrooms, particularly at the post-secondary environment, which is already set up in this patriarchal kind of way that favors the ways of knowing of European white males. And so it's even within that context, there are some barriers set up. I mean, I myself was raised in a very, you might even say, typical Canadian family that were equity and social justice issues were pretty invisible. So I think the word you use, problematizing, is really the key, because it's about trying to trouble these notions, trying to foreground them and deconstruct the way we have of doing everything in our lives. And so it really involves putting our students on unstable ground and allowing them to rethink all of their taken-for-granted notions about schools, about themselves, about Canada. And these are pretty deep, so it's kind of almost about our value system. Like if you say, describe yourself as a person, or these are the kinds of things that come right to our core. So inviting students to question all of those things. I know some people that do it in a very kind of in-your-face, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. We're all racist. It is. We're all part of a racist system. I try ways that use my insider status as a white person who's also trying to unlearn racism, and lead them through some stages of discomfort. That showing films, let's say having speakers who speak very articulately on these notions, and engaging in different forms of education and trying to really enact a type of democratizing of the classroom where student voices are heard, where their experiences are valued, and we build on those, through the semester. So it's a kind of a messy task, but it's been super rewarding and just a little bit painful.
But in order to be aware of the ways in which we self-censor ourselves, we also need to be aware of the kinds of structures that are put in place to censor us. So what are some of those structures?
Well, I mean, virtually everything. I mean, you could look at the systemic issues around the academy itself, like the way universities are set up, how equitable are they? I mean, if you look at the merit system and the gatekeeping and who's let in and who isn't and what kind of positions do people of different identities and life experiences, what type of positions do they get at the university? Who's promoted and who's kept in the sort of low status instructional positions? And we see that it's, for the most part over the years has been people of color and women and other marginalized groups. I mean, we do see some positive changes. We do see universities that have really tackled equity in meaningful ways, that is, through of employment equity and other kinds of ways. So that's just looking at it, you know, one aspect of the structure of schooling. But who is in those classes, and who's leading those classes, and who's represented as academic and life role models for students? And obviously, this also applies to who do we admit. So, what are our admissions criteria, and who do those favor? And you can just see how this is completely systemic, and how, you know, white middle classness, how affluent children of white successful families do very, very well. They're bound to, because the system was created for kids exactly like them, so, or for people like them. So, in another way, you know, we have some really deep systemic work to do in addition to the sort of the day-to-day work that we do in classes.
My particular interest with education is social justice, and I went to a conference on social justice, and what I found extremely disappointing was that most of the people present said, well, the problem with social justice is that it has so many definitions. It can be defined in so many ways, and so it became this sort of game of semantics, and I stood up and I said, well, look, I said, it's interesting that we have this discussion in this classroom, you know, surrounded by people who have wealth, privilege. And I said, if you went to a Latin American classroom and asked what is social justice, I said, a child could define it for you. I said, so I'll give you my definition. I said, you know, for me, social justice means a society that offers equity of opportunities for all children, you know, regardless mm-hmm. of what color their faces are, or, you know, what kind of home they live in. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this difficulty conceptualizing what equity is, because one of my classmates stood up and said, well, we can't all be equal. That's silly. So how do we... So I'm looking for help here.
And I mean, she has a point in that we're about equality of opportunity, and that is equity, as you said it, that every single person should have the same access to the good life, or to health, to services, to education, to all of the wonderful things in life. So that's equity, but each of us needs different things to achieve that, right? So it isn't about we're all exactly the same people. So that discourse is, I find, problematic, like the color blindness, where some people mistakenly think that if they just ignore difference, that's the secret to a harmonious world, that just completely, you know, blind ourselves to any uniqueness among peoples and cultures and ability levels, and that's somehow the secret. And in fact, that just absolves us of any responsibility for addressing issues of inequity. But I think, you know, you've touched on an important aspect that I also see in the social justice community, and that is these issues are so big and so complex and also so interwoven, sometimes in really contradictory ways and in complex ways that really defy a simple, well, you're this, so you're a victim, and you're this, so you're an oppressor. There's so many complexities in our identities, and each context, each situation we find ourselves in brings a nuance, right, where now one thing comes to the fore and something else drifts back a bit, but yet they're all interconnected. So that alone makes this a very challenging issue, and so it, almost as a means of practicality, we've seen a fragmentation in the social justice scene where, you know, nobody's talking about transphobia. So we need to form a group, or, you know, why is ableism never talked about when, you know, when we're talking about racism? Or you know, the arguments you've obviously heard as well, that, you know, we can only do so much, and this is the group that talks about this, we don't talk about that. But as you say, at the core, it's all the same task. We're all seeking you know, a more socially just society where really we're getting the most out of every single person who lives here. So it's, you know, it benefits all of us. And I think making that argument is that it's not about individuals and splinter groups seeking some special right or privilege. It's really about every single person being afforded a seat at the same table.
And that, I think, it's the one perhaps that makes most people uncomfortable, because we do live in a society that is organized about maximizing wealth and privilege in the hands of a few. So the more hands you have, the more people you have to compete with. So perhaps it's not so naive that that isn't put in place. So let's talk a little bit about that, because in your book, you not only conceptualize whiteness, but you also talk about the implications for different groups. And I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about this sense of we can't just feel guilty forever, and so, you know, my kid needs to have a decent life, so if that means leaving some kids out, well, you know, that's what it is. That's the world we live in. How do we overcome the fact that we live in a capitalist, you know, post-industrial world where there is limited opportunities, and race has been a very useful tool to create privilege for few and advantages for some, while disadvantaging many people?
That's so true. It's we are living in this capitalist world that's fueled by greed and competition, right? But I mean, so is the building I work in, where, you know, it's fueled by merit pay that takes money from one scholar to give to another, that we only get a certain amount for everybody. So my success harms someone else. Someone else's success materially harms me. It's a really toxic system. But yet a number of us choose to work in spite of that. We work collaboratively anyways. In a sense, we're all living in this oppressive, ridiculously imbalanced system where most of these barriers and forms of oppression are virtually invisible to most of the players. That is, you and I are talking about it today, but if you just walk up on the street to the average Canadian and say, hey, is there much racism in Canada these days? Most people just would look at you like you're crazy, like we've completely gone past that. So our additional burden, not just to make this case that it's important to eliminate barriers and it's important to share resources and to bring more people to the table, I mean, it's hard for people to even recognize inequity. We've been so trained to ignore it. We've been so trained to rationalize it that we can see how horrible apartheid is, but we can't see that with our own indigenous peoples and how quickly we're able to just dismiss their basic humanity. And I mean so many people, this just seems to be so easy for us to just say, oh, yeah, but don't get me started on First Nations people. But the monumental task is doable, I think, and it is important. And I don't think it has to be I have to lose something in order for you to gain something. I don't look at the world that way. And I've never met Paulo Freire, but some friends of mine who work with his work more directly have. And he said there's nothing wrong with seeking a good life for your family and having a nice home and good things for your children. I mean, what parent wouldn't want that? But that doesn't mean that we have to ignore other children in doing so, and it doesn't mean that we can't seek that same life or the same, you know, happiness and freedom and all of that for every single child on the planet. Maybe where there's a kernel of hope, and that is Canadians in some way, you know, we kind of believe this deep down about education and healthcare, that, you know what, I don't care if I don't use that emergency ward this year. I think it's important for us to have one. You know, that we kind of all, you know, we're chipping in for the greater good. And I think that's the spirit that we have to tap into, that there's something beneficial to all of us when there are reduced barriers for everyone.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. I really love the book. How can people access your book?
Well, it's easy to find on Amazon if you just search Great White North ? And Darren Lund and Paul Carr, the co-editors, but also Sense Publishers, that's S-E-N-S-E Publishers, and you can order it either place.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thanks so much, Sylvia.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
That was Dr. Darren Lund. He's a professor at the University of Calgary. His latest book is The Great White North, Exploring Whiteness, Privilege, and Identity in Education.
come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.